Okay, it is August 19th, 2010. We are at Paul Weiss's Washington, D.C. office interviewing Mr. Barry Zubrow at Paul Weiss's New York office, I think. Mr. Zubrow, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today. My name is Chris Seifer. These folks are also all with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We were established by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009. It tells us to figure out the various causes of the financial crisis and deliver a report by December 15th of this year, which we certainly hope to do. That statute tells us to do several things in terms of figuring out those causes, including looking at the issue of systemically important institutions, too big to fail institutions. Tells us to look at any institution that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of government assistance. That is one of the reasons we are looking at Lehman, or those are a couple of the reasons we are looking at Lehman Brothers. As part of that investigation, we have also been talking to a lot of Lehman's counterparties to understand how they were managing their exposures and what they thought about the company. That is why we identified J.P. Morgan, and that is why they so nicely identified you as somebody that would be good to talk to help us understand that. So with that, before we get to the substance, could you please briefly summarize your educational and work background, starting with college, please?
Sure, happy to do that. One point to note is actually we're here gathered at J.P. Morgan Chase offices. And one thing that would help me at least is if you could maybe quickly go around the table and just identify who everybody is there. I realize that you're all from the commission, but we'd love to know who's with you.
Sure, why don't everybody just say who they are?
Hi, Tom Stanton. We met earlier.
Yes, Tom. Hi.
Art Wilmarth.
Sarah Knauss. Donna Norman.
And I'm Joe Biedengannon.
Okay, great. I am Barry Zubrow. I'm the Chief Risk Officer for J.P. Morgan Chase. I've been with the firm for close to 3 years, having joined in December 2007. Prior to that, going back, as you asked for my educational background, I'm a graduate of Haverford College, and a graduate of the University of Chicago Business School and the University of Chicago Law School. When I graduated from graduate school, as well as during graduate school, I was employed at Goldman Sachs and Co., and I had a number of different jobs at Goldman Sachs, including being the chief credit officer, as well as the chief administrative officer. I retired from Goldman Sachs approximately 2004, was involved in a number of board service, as well as advising the governor of New Jersey, John Corzine, for a number of years, and then joined J.P. Morgan, as I said.
Okay, could you just briefly explain your job responsibilities as Chief Risk Officer at J.P. Morgan Chase?
Sure, and as Tom knows, this was the subject of a more in-depth discussion as to how we're organized at J.P. Morgan Chase, but I am the Chief Risk Officer. I'm a member of the firm's operating committee. I report to the CEO and am accountable to the board of directors, and in each of our lines of business, there is a chief risk officer as well as a risk organization, that reports to me, and I'm responsible for their functions.
Okay. So explain to me overall how J.P. Morgan Chase, manages its various counterparty risk exposures, and then we'll get into Lehman specifically.
Okay. In a number of our businesses, we take, we have counterparty risk exposures, which include, credit exposures, operating exposures, other types of exposures. And probably the two businesses that are most relevant are the investment banking business and our treasury and security services businesses. But in each of these cases, we evaluate the credit worthiness of the counterparty, evaluate the type of business that they're in, what business they want to do, and then have an ongoing dialogue with them about their, you know, current business prospects, and, you know, whether or not the amount of credit that we may or may not be extending to them at any point in time is, you know, appropriate from a risk standpoint, and whether they're whether the operating exposures we have to them, you know, are appropriate in the context of how their business is doing.
Okay. And what were the types of exposures that J.P. Morgan Chase had with Lehman?
Obviously, Lehman Brothers, as a major global financial institution, you know, had many different points of contact with J.P. Morgan Chase, and in the period of time, you know, prior to their going bankrupt, we were engaged with them across the spectrum of their different businesses. We served as the clearance and settlement agent for a lot of their government clearance and securities clearance activities, which meant that we were facilitating the settlement of thousands of transactions a day between Lehman and their other trading counterparties. We also provided a significant amount of credit to Lehman as the agent bank for their tri-party repo financing transactions with investors. And in addition, from time to time, we provided direct bilateral credit under credit agreements to various entities within the Lehman organization. In addition, as a trading counterparty of Lehman, we would enter into transactions, you know, with Lehman. They might be derivative transactions or other trading type of transactions, you know, which gave rise to market and credit exposure to Lehman. And then finally, in other parts of our business, in particular the asset management business, where we manage money for independent clients, there would have been transactions where we, as an asset manager, were trading with or investing in Lehman paper on behalf of other clients.
So explain to me, you had mentioned earlier the way you would manage exposures was evaluating creditworthiness, figuring out what business they're in, what business they want to do, ongoing dialogue, etc. Explain to me how, you know, a little more specifically in terms of Lehman, how you evaluated their creditworthiness and determined what kind of exposures that J.P. Morgan Chase was willing to take.
Well, as a general matter, and certainly applicable in the Lehman case, you know, we have a team of credit experts, you know, that would evaluate the balance sheet and business prospects of, you know, all of our counterparties, would meet with, you know, various representatives of a company's management, would evaluate their financial statements and their you know, financial prospects for their business, and would also evaluate, you know, how the marketplace was evaluating, you know, what the creditworthiness of a particular counterparty might be.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Who were that? Now, you mentioned like 1, 2, 3, you know, 5 different types of businesses or services that you guys, or relationships that you had with Lehman. To the extent you can recall, who were the folks at Lehman that J.P. Morgan Chase was dealing with in terms of the clearing and settlement activities?
Most of the clearance and settlement activity business, you know, would have been managed at Lehman as well as at other counterparties by their treasury staff within their finance organization.
Okay. Were you personally involved with managing the Lehman exposures, or did you have, you know, direct reports that were doing the day-to-day work?
The day-to-day work was conducted by relationship managers as well as credit experts, you know, within, you know, that are in the different lines of business. I did participate from time to time in some meetings with senior people at Lehman Brothers during the summer of 2008.
I think maybe probably the best way to start out on this is, can you just walk us through sort of chronologically, you know, how J.P. Morgan Chase was managing its counterparty exposure to Lehman and how it changed over time? And I think probably starting with Bear, but if it makes sense to, for example, go back to the fall of 07 when the credit market started to seize up, go back to that point.
Well, I guess if I would sort of start with the fall of 07 in that general time frame, and again recognizing that I joined the firm in December of 07, so I did not directly participate in some of the discussions that were obviously going on before that, during the period of time from December on when I joined the firm, we were evaluating, you know, our exposure to a number of financial institutions, Lehman included, in which we were trying to make an assessment of what was the appropriate amount of credit to be extending to them on a bilateral basis, as well as having an ongoing dialogue about the dynamics of the tri-party repo marketplace and the character of the securities and the haircuts that were being utilized within the tri-party market. And I would say that during the period running up from the fall of 07 to the takeover of Bear Stearns, We, in general, were trying to evaluate how counterparties like Lehman were financing themselves in the tri-party marketplace, the composition of the collateral in the tri-party marketplace, as well as what the pricing of those securities were. And in general, we're looking to make sure that the tri-party marketplace mechanisms were being used on a fully collateralized basis, and we're not looking to extend additional credit to the tri-party firms beyond what was supported by the direct collateral amounts.
And certainly no later than the fall of 07 anyway, I think there were some issues about valuations of collateral, at least uncertainty about valuations of collateral. So what were you guys finding generally and specifically as it relates to Lehman?
I'm sorry, at what point in time were you in the asking about?
The time frame you just covered, fall of 07 through March of 08.
Right. So I would say that during that time frame, as we evaluated the overall tri-party marketplace and worked with our colleagues at the New York Fed in helping them understand the dynamics of the marketplace, you know, we were concerned about the heavy reliance that the securities firms were placing on financing themselves through the tri-party marketplace, and the shift in the composition of the collateral that investors were prepared to lend against that had occurred certainly over a number of years leading up to that time frame. So as I think you're aware, the tri-party marketplace was originally designed as a mechanism for securities firms to be able to finance their government and U.S. agency type of collateral. But over time, the types of collateral that investors had been willing to lend against had shifted to less liquid, harder to price collateral, and in a number of instances, Lehman included, the composition of the very liquid, easy to value, safer government securities type collateral had significantly decreased in the tri-party book of business. And so, you know, for Lehman at that point in time, the percentage of the very high-quality collateral had declined. I don't remember the exact percentage, but I think it was probably, you know, declined to roughly, you know, 60%, you know, of their book.
Even before you get to August of 07, I take it for the more illiquid, harder to value securities, there were larger haircuts?
Well, since I wasn't here before, you know, during that period of time, you know, I don't have the specifics of what the haircuts were, but I would say as a general matter that, you know, again, the haircuts were set by the investors in their bilateral dealings with the brokerage firm counterparts. But I would say as a general matter, there was probably less discrimination on the size of the haircuts in those relationships than there certainly should have been.
And I, the question wasn't just specific to Lehman or your time at J.P. Morgan Chase, but just your experience of knowing the tri-party market in general. But was that your experience, that even though there were these more illiquid, harder-to-value securities, that the haircuts were not that different from the agencies and the government securities?
Yes, as a general matter, you know, as I said, I don't think investors fully discriminated on the type of securities and what was the appropriate amount of haircut that should be applied on a security by security basis, you know, as, you know, prudent lending would certainly have suggested. And I think that that situation obviously, you know, reflected itself throughout that period of time. And if you roll all the way forward to even earlier, you know, this year, you know, when under the auspices of the New York Fed's Payments Committee, the Fed, you know, certainly with our encouragement and support, you know, was able to organize industry-wide discussions of these issues. You know, I think in that report, it comes out very clearly that investors, you know, have not historically been as focused as they should be on the character of the collateral that they, the investors, were financing.
So how was J.P. Morgan managing either its, you know, as an investor, bilateral repo exposure to Lehman, or as the clearing bank providing the intraday credit?
So, again, I think that let's just sort of separate out the terms a little bit. You know, as the clearance and settlement bank for Lehman's businesses and transactions, you know, in that business, we're not providing credit, and our exposure is really an operational exposure. In our role as agent bank in the tri-party marketplace, you know, we're the agent bank as agent in between the investors and Lehman Brothers. In that role, there is the process that was called the daily unwind process. So an investor finances the collateral overnight, and then in order to have the cash in the morning go back to the investor for their use and to allow Lehman Brothers to use the collateral during the daytime, we would take on a collateralized exposure to Lehman or to other tri-party counterparties, so that our credit extension occurred, you know, in the morning for the period of time of during the day until investors would reinvest in the tri-party relationship and make a new lending overnight.
Right, right. And I apologize. I'm not a street guy or certainly not a chief risk officer type guy, but that exposure that you just described as an agent bank is the intraday exposure, right?
That is correct.
Okay. So how did J.P. Morgan manage that exposure? I guess let's first talk generally, but obviously I'm interested in how they specifically manage the exposure with Lehman. And again, over time, you know, we're still in this fall 07 to March 08 time frame, but let's just walk through it, you know, and go beyond that too.
So in the period of time, you know, sort of fall 07 and prior to that, we would enter into we basically were providing additional credit to Lehman Brothers, in which we would provide both unsecured lending as well as secured lending against the collateral to them in, you know, the late fall of 07, you know, as I said. You know, we had an overall review of the broker-dealer community, the exposures that we as a bank had to that community, and the dynamics of the marketplace, and came to a credit judgment, you know, that we thought that we should not be providing the additional amount of unsecured lending in these arrangements on that daily unwind, and so work to limit our credit exposure to the amount of the collateral that was there, but we would often provide a credit that was equal to the amount of collateral and did not always take as large a haircut during that period of time. And then in the period of time subsequent to Bear Stearns's failure, we made a decision that we thought that it was very important to try to make sure that we maintained a additional amount of haircut, you know, for our intraday exposures, reflective of the dynamics of the collateral that was being financed and the amount of leverage that the broker-dealer community had.
And was that, it sounds like from your description, that was across the board for all the broker-dealers, not just specific to one of the four?
That is correct. And so during that period of time, we, you know, worked with, you know, all of our broker-dealer clients to help them with a transition to a regime in which we sought to, at a minimum, maintain the amount of investor haircut during the intraday exposure. And so as a initial approximation of what we thought would be a good starting point of haircut to have, we worked with the broker-dealer clients to have them understand that we thought that at a minimum, and it was just as a minimum standard, you know, that we would use as a guide the amount of haircut that they were negotiating with their investor clients. But we did that recognizing that that was an imperfect approximation of what appropriate haircuts should be, but one which we thought was operationally more able to be implemented over a shorter period of time during the course of the summer of 2008. And as I said, that was something that we did, you know, across all of our investing clients. And we also did it very much in a constructive dialogue with our broker-dealer clients, and also did it in conjunction with keeping the Fed very much apprised of what we were doing, the pace of migration that we were applying the higher haircuts to the clients with. There was certainly a recognition that the broker-dealer clients, you know, had a very high degree of leverage, which was partly reflected by the fact, you know, that they had been financing their inventories, you know, particularly the less liquid inventories, you know, at a tighter haircut than, you know, maybe was appropriate to reflect the riskiness of those assets. And we wanted to make sure in working with our clients that we did so in a way which would allow them to have an appropriate transition, you know, to the higher credit standards.
So explain to me if you can, or quantify it to the extent if you can. I mean, I get that you're saying, I forget what the numbers were, but you were talking about, I think either 40 or 60%, you know, of the securities being financed through the tri-party repo market were these illiquid, harder-to-value securities that, of course, you folks probably aren't that comfortable with as the tri-party clearing bank providing the intraday credit. So, at the same time, of course, the broker-dealer wants to be able to finance it. So, what are you doing in this 2008 time frame when you're working constructively with the broker dealers? You know, what kind of haircuts are you requiring on the less liquid, harder to value assets? Are you saying we're not going to finance those assets? What's changing, if anything, with the financing or the haircuts on the government securities and the agencies? If you can, just provide us some more granularity on the types of securities that are being financed through the tri-party repo clearing.
So I guess first I would say that when we started working, you know, with the broker-dealer community in trying to establish higher haircuts for the intraday credit exposure, we started out with the broker-dealers at a metric of, I think it was roughly 20% of the investor margin, and said that we wanted to, at a minimum, retain at least 20% of the amount of margin that was being retained by investors overnight, and said that we wanted to try to migrate to at least 100% of the investor margin over the next several months, so a period of from 3 to 6 months, depending on, you know, the individual clients and the individual composition of their book. In addition, we also explain to all the investor clients that, particularly with respect to the what we're generally called the DTC, or Depository Trust Corporation securities, i.e. those securities that were cleared and settled through DTC and not cleared and settled through the Fed, and as a general matter, it was those securities that tended to be, to include the set of securities that would be less liquid, harder to value, although not all DTC securities are less liquid or hard to value. So certainly some of the book of DTC securities included, liquid tradable equities. But for that cohort of securities, we also, worked with our clients to try to better understand the pricing of those securities and the pricing services that were being used within the tri-party repo marketplace for the pricing and valuation of the most difficult to value securities, which were typically securities such as, structured loans, structured mortgage product, and so on.
And again, in terms of these discussions on these two points you just made, this is the post Bear Stearns time frame?
Yes.
Okay. So you mentioned that a couple of times that you were also, talking to the Fed, or Federal Reserve Bank of New York, while this is going on. Were you expressing concerns to the Federal Reserve? Well, I guess, what were you telling the Federal Reserve Bank of New York?
We thought that it was very important for the Fed to have our perspective as a major participant in this marketplace, as one of the two agent banks for the tri-party marketplace. What the character of our book was, the percentage of securities that were more highly liquid versus, less liquid. And to work with the Fed to try to encourage better best practices, particularly among investing clients as well as the broker-dealer community, on how to value these securities and what appropriate haircuts were. In addition, during that time period, so the time period post Bear Stearns and during the summer of 2008, we also actively worked with the Counterparty Risk Management Group number 3, which was a private industry sponsored group comprising a number of the largest securities firms and banks, to evaluate what were best practices in the marketplace across a number of risk management and other marketplace functions post Bear Stearns. And one of the topics of CRMPG3 was the tri-party repo marketplace and what might be, what would be appropriate best practices should be in that marketplace. And we thought that it was very important that we try to get clear buy-in by the marketplace. And in this case, again, the marketplace would be the broker-dealers on the one hand and the investing clients on the other hand, as to what best practices should be, so that we could migrate that marketplace to be to reflect less leverage around these harder to price securities, and to be able to have a migration path, you know, that would lead to a more stable marketplace.
These discussions, the discussions that you're having both with, you know, the New York Fed and with your counterparties on, you know, having better practices, having less risk for you guys because of the questions about the liquidity and value of these securities, is Bank of New York doing this too? Do you know?
We hear silence. I don't know if they're in Washington or New York, but
it's here.
Okay. I believe that Bank of New York was participating in similar types of discussions, although I don't believe, in fact, Bank of New York was not a direct member participant of the CRMPG3 discussions, but certainly they were very much aware of what were being articulated as best practices through that process, and the Fed was certainly having bilateral discussions with them, and I think that it's my general impression that the Bank of New York certainly shared the concern of trying to make sure that we work to have a more robust tri-party repo marketplace. I do think it's very important to just go back and point out that, you know, our efforts in this regard, you know, were only in part relative to our own credit exposures or our own exposures in the marketplace, but were, you know, very much to try to strengthen the dynamics of this marketplace, because we recognized that this was a critical way in which the broker-dealer community finances their inventory, and we thought that it was very important for the safety and soundness of the overall marketplace that the overall leverage that was being provided to the broker-dealer community through these marketplace mechanisms should be decreased. And we thought that, and therefore we wanted to try to get these additional best practices to be adopted so that the marketplace could migrate to a stronger position.
So in this post-bear through moving into the summer of 2008, you mentioned that post-bear you wanted to work the broker-dealers over a 3 to 6 month period of getting to better practices, more secured. Is there any difference in how J.P. Morgan Chase is dealing with any of the broker-dealers, or is it pretty much straight across the board? And, of course, I'm interested in Lehman, since that's the institution we're looking at. Are your dealings with Lehman in this March, April, May, June, July time frame the same as with the other broker-dealers, or is there less, more, same concern with Lehman than with the others?
I would say that the concepts were the same across, you know, all of the different clients, but that what the appropriate migration path was and how we thought about the individual pricing issues would vary based on what the composition of an individual broker-dealer's book of financing in the tri-party marketplace actually was. So not all broker-dealers had a large percentage of their financing in tri-party be in the less liquid, less robust or easy to price securities.
And where did Lehman fall in that?
I would say that Lehman was certainly had a very significant percentage of their financing was against the DTC type of collateral. We consistently expressed our concern to Lehman Management about the percentage of their book that that reflected. And we also had discussions with them about, you know, the pricing services around a large, you know, portion of that DTC type of collateral. And in addition, you know, during the summer of 2008, you know, we, with Lehman Brothers, as well as with the other broker-dealer clients, you know, introduced a concept of trying to move to a risk-based haircut pricing mechanism, you know, what we sort of call dynamic margining, which we thought would better capture the type of margining that would be appropriate for these securities on an intraday basis. So again, as we said, the period immediately post Bear Stearns, you know, we were working with the broker dealer clients using the investor haircuts as a proxy for what the right amount of haircut was. I think that we and our broker-dealer clients recognized that that was not necessarily the best way to measure what the appropriate amount of haircut should be, and in fact started working with the broker-dealer clients during the summer of 08 to move to a in-house dynamic modeled set of haircuts in which, you know, we would be able to set haircuts that we thought were appropriate for different categories of securities, you know, based on our own credit judgments and our own market judgments, and not use the investors as the proxy for that.
Did J.P. Morgan Chase, did you folks maintain any kind of reports that would sort of list, you know, the various broker-dealers and, you know, how much is government and agency, how much is DTC, and what the various haircuts were over time?
Yes, we did, as part of the ongoing reporting of the of that business. You know, that that business would certainly produce those types of reports.
Is that a daily, a weekly, a monthly, a...
It would be a daily process.
Okay. Hey, Eric, you know, I don't know that I want the dailies, but it might be worth seeing, you know, like the monthlies on those from, you know, August of 07 through 08, you know, through the end of 08, if that's something that's not too much trouble to put your hands on. That way it would give us a nice picture of you know, sort of the comparative, you know, books of the various broker-dealers. If that's something you guys could put your hands on, that would be great.
I don't know what's there, Chris, but we'll certainly look.
Okay, thanks. So at any time when you're going through this post-Bear Stearns March 08 time frame with the various broker-dealer clients and getting them to better practices, reduce leverage, get you folks in a more secure position, and you're talking to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, did you ever have any discussions with the folks at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York about, we're going to stop financing, providing intraday financing to any broker-dealers because you were just too uncomfortable with their collateral?
No, I don't believe at any point in time did we ever say that we would stop financing you know, the broker-dealer clients. We thought that it was very important to try to have an orderly transition to a less leveraged broker-dealer clientele. And obviously, you know, particularly with respect to our clients, you know, they in fact are our clients, and, you know, they represented, you know, important business opportunities for us. So, you know, our objective throughout was to try to have a migration path to a, you know, a safer marketplace in which, you know, we'd be able to continue to have, you know, ongoing business relationships.
A similar question. Ever have any discussions with the New York Fed about them essentially stepping into the shoes of a J.P. Morgan or a Boney and providing the intraday financing?
We certainly had lots of discussions with the New York Fed about what was the right structure for the tri-party repo marketplace and what was the right role of the agent banks. And throughout the period of time from September 11th of 2001 over the subsequent, you know, I'll call it decade for simplicity, the Fed led a very extensive effort to talk about whether or not the tri-party repo marketplace should be structured with J.P. Morgan and Bank of New York as the two agent banks, because, in fact, as you no doubt are aware, on September 11, 2001, Boney had significant communication problems because their communication pipes went under the World Trade Center and they lost connectivity to the street. And so the Fed was very legitimately concerned about the robustness of the model in which so much of the financing of that marketplace was dependent on the two providers. And without, I mean, we could certainly spend all afternoon talking about all the different things that were talked about during that period of time, that's probably not really relevant to the discussion today. But in that context, there were lots of discussions with the Fed about, you know, were there different ways in which this marketplace could be structured.
Right. I will tell you that one of the reasons for my question, we have seen documents that indicate anyway that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York was looking at the possibility of having to provide up to $200 billion of intraday credit to Lehman Brothers, at least implying that, you know, J.P. Morgan Chase or Boney, to the extent they were providing clearing services to Lehman too, were thinking about getting out of the game.
Okay, well, I'm not familiar with what those documents are, and I don't know what the context was or whatever the Fed might have been looking at.
It doesn't jog any memory bells in terms of in the June, July, August 2008 time frame of J.P. Morgan, you know, talking about, you know, not providing intraday clearing services for Lehman Brothers in that time frame?
No.
Okay. So let's talk a little more specifically about Lehman. We've been talking about the summer of 08. We do know from some of the documents that have been produced that I think in August of 08, there's some new documentation that's done between Lehman and J.P. Morgan Chase. Are you familiar with that?
I'm generally familiar with that, yes.
Okay, I mean, if we're not there yet in your chronology, that's fine, but take me through, continue the chronology on dealing with Lehman anyway, and if we're up to August, let's talk about those change of agreements. If not, you know, tell me what else is going on between J.P. Morgan and Lehman in terms of getting them to pursue, along with the others, better practices, better haircuts, get more comfort with the DTC types of securities, et cetera.
Well, so during the course of the summer, we were continuing to develop our, you know, dynamic intraday margining view of the exposures in the tri-party marketplace, and also continuing to migrate the the broker dealers to at least the investor amount of haircut. In the end of August time frame, in evaluating what was the gap between the amount of intraday margin that we had for the Lehman book of business and the investor margin and the amount of dynamic intraday margining, we thought that gap between what Lehman should be providing as intraday haircuts against their book of collateral and what they were at that point leaving us with was, as much as I think, if my memory serves me correctly, $6 billion of a gap. And in our discussions with Lehman, we said there were lots of discussions with Lehman about how to effectuate the intraday dynamic margining. There were discussions with them over the different pricing engines, and there was a recognition that there were some systems issues on their side, and there were some systems issues on our side, but that there was a recognition that there was this additional amount of margin that was required in order to be able to get us to the type of intraday margin haircuts that we, and I think frankly they, thought was appropriate to reflect the character of their book of collateral and business. And we agreed that they would post a sum of additional collateral in effect to tide us over to the point where we could have the more robust systems work completed. And so the end of August agreements that I think you're referring to reflected the agreements under which that roughly $5 billion worth of collateral was posted. And again, I think it's important to understand that, the design of the tri-party repo marketplace is as a collateralized business. And so the idea of the haircuts was to make sure that during the day that there was sufficient collateral still in-house at J.P. Morgan such that if there was a credit event, that we would have sufficient collateral to be able to cover us for any diminution in value of the collateral, which was the subject of the original credit extension.
Mm-hmm. How did J.P. Morgan go about valuing the collateral?
We used different pricing services during that period of time to value the collateral and to arrive at prices that were meant to reflect a current market price of the collateral. But all of those pricing services, by their nature, were at least 1 and sometimes 2 days out of, historical, and certainly did not reflect any intraday changes in pricing of a security. And then we would take those prices and then for different classes of securities, would set a additional haircut amount, which we thought reflected a estimate of what the diminution in price might be if there was a credit event for the broker-dealer, you know, that would require us to have to take over the collateral and then try to liquidate it.
Okay. I suspect we may see this in the reports that I know Eric's going to find for me before the end of the day. But were there other broker-dealers besides Lehman Brothers that you had as much concern, that you entered into agreements to say we need another $5 billion, or, you know, words to that effect? I mean, was Lehman the biggest concern of J.P. Morgan? Were they one of several?
Well, I think that, as I said, we were having the overall discussions about the dynamics of the tri-party repo market with all of our tri-party dealer clients. There certainly were other broker-dealers that we thought, you know, had significant exposure to DTC type of collateral, and with whom we were having, you know, these same types of ongoing discussions.
But, and I understand that, but I mean, can you, if you can't do it, that's fine. But I'm just wondering, you know, where Lehman falls in the spectrum. I mean, were they the broker-dealer that you had the biggest concern with, and therefore you did this end of August 2008 agreement? Were there other broker-dealers you did similar agreements with?
I actually don't remember whether there were other broker-dealers with whom we did a similar type of agreement, because, again, part of the August agreement was to bridge the gap between the investor margin and the dynamic intraday margining and some of the specific pricing issues that reflected the character of the Lehman book of business. We were having similar discussions with other broker-dealers to, at a minimum, get to the amount of investor margin, and we certainly had discussions with some other broker-dealers about an additional amount of margin. I just don't remember whether we had an actual agreement in August with other broker-dealers for that type of collateral arrangement.
Okay, thank you. I understand you don't recall if there was a written agreement. Can you say whether or not, you know, the broker-dealer that was of the most concern was Lehman? Was it somebody else? Was it Lehman and others? I'm just trying to get a sense of where Lehman's falling within the counterparty risk management exposure concerns of J.P. Morgan Chase.
I would say that as a general matter, both reflecting their exposures in the tri-party marketplace, as well as, you know, other exposures, you know, we were probably most concerned about the overall credit viability of Lehman Brothers as well as Merrill Lynch.
And putting aside the issue of written agreements, were you getting additional collateral posted by Merrill Lynch also?
We were certainly working with them to change the amount of collateral that we had on an intraday basis, migrating them along the same type of path that we talked about to be able to get to the full investor haircuts and trying to make sure that, you know, they got to that level.
Well, what about Morgan Stanley and Goldman? I mean, clearly less of an issue than Merrill and Lehman than what you said, but are you also working with them to get them to migrate and to you know, follow better practices, be less leveraged, et cetera?
I think it's important to understand that Goldman and Morgan Stanley, you know, were not tri-party repo, you know, Asian bank clients of J.P. Morgan.
Okay.
We do some clearance and settlement activity for those two firms, and we certainly had other counterparty exposure to those firms, but they were not part of our direct dialogue on the tri-party side because they were clients for this purpose of the Bank of New York, although those firms, in particular Goldman, certainly participated with us in the broader discussion, both under the auspices of the CRMPG3, as well as in general, on what we talked about as best practices for the tri-party marketplace.
So during this time period, were the investors, you know, that are providing the overnight financing, requiring better practices, less leverage, more collateral, bigger haircuts?
I would say, as a general matter, the investors took a much more benign attitude to these exposures, than certainly looking back, you would hope that they would do, given their fiduciary responsibilities. But you'd have to go through and look at, how each individual investing complex thought about it.
When you did the $5 billion or $6 billion deal, I forget what you said, in August of 2008 with Lehman, did that bring Lehman to 100% of the investor haircuts, or did it not bring you up that far?
I believe that it brought us up to 100% of the investor haircuts, but that there was still a gap between that amount and the modeling which we had done under the dynamic intraday margining. And I would say that from the end of August onwards, our discussions, with Lehman all really centered around the need to get to an amount of haircuts that more closely approximated the dynamic intraday margining. And so without... I'm trying to think of the best way to express the series of numbers, but I guess I would say that the August 5 to 6 billion dollars of collateral, got us probably halfway to that totally robust dynamic intraday margining, so that in fact in August of 2008, to get to the full robust intraday dynamic margining, we would have needed additional collateral of approximately $12 billion. All these numbers end up obviously being approximate because the nature of what Lehman was financing on any given day would change and would move around, as well as would the pricing and valuation of the security. And in addition, there was a lot of discussion with Lehman about whether or not they should get relief for what they described as term repo. And so in their view, there was a portion of their book of business in which they and their investors had agreed on a maturity date for the repo that extended beyond the overnight one-day period that was subject to the one-day unwind. And was there some way to carve out that book of business and sort of put it aside, so that we would not need to hold back the additional dynamic margining against that book of business. And I think that we worked very closely with Lehman to try to better define what was the amount that might fall into that bucket of term repo. And throughout the end of August and beginning of September period, I think there was a lot of efforts to do that, although given the confluence of events in early September, we never really got to either a operational mechanic that could do that, nor to a clear demonstration of how much of their repo was actually term repo. But that's one of the reasons why in some of these discussions, you might see, different amounts of, different types of numbers, being talked about is what the right dynamic intraday margining should be.
Okay. When J.P. Morgan and Lehman executed the August 08 agreements, did J.P. Morgan, did you guys tell Lehman that, look, we're not going to be willing to be your agent bank anymore if you don't execute these agreements? And post the money.
Not that I'm aware of. Throughout all this period, our discussions with them were very much what can we do to help facilitate their being able to have the right arrangements to support their business, and in doing that to also make sure that the credit exposures that were, hundreds of billions of dollars that J.P. Morgan was taking were properly collateralized under different market scenarios. And frankly, I think all our discussions with the Treasury staff of Lehman, were done very much in a appropriate, bilateral client relationship, trying to get to a set of agreements that allowed them to continue to finance the inventory they wanted to finance and allowed us, on the other hand, to have, appropriate credit comfort for the, hundreds of billions of dollars of financing that we were providing, on a collateralized basis, every day for them.
Do you recall, in terms of working with Merrill Lynch, did you get them to 100% of investor haircuts at the time B of A acquired them over the same weekend that Lehman filed bankruptcy?
I just don't recall at exactly where they were relative to that metric of investor haircut.
Okay. So let's just keep moving along chronologically and move into September now. I'm sure when things get a little more interesting. So why don't you just take us into, the first 2 weeks of September.
Okay. So moving into the first 2 weeks of September. So you'll have the dates in your mind better than I do, and I just don't recall whether at the end of August or whether it was September, the very first day or two of September, we had a long scheduled meeting with Lehman Brothers, in which I and some of my colleagues in the credit area and the clearance and settlement area had a meeting with senior representatives of Treasury from Lehman Brothers to talk about, to be updated on how their business was doing. At that point, their third quarter had just completed, and we wanted to get a sense as to, you know, how their business was doing and what they were going to be reporting for their third quarter earnings. And so we had a we sat down and met with them, and they shared with us, you know, what their results, you know, were approximately going to be, and also told us at that time that they had been working on, you know, a number of different types of strategic transactions. One was potential, or, you know, I guess they've been having a number of discussions about potential strategic investments from outside parties, and they also had been working on a strategy to spin off a number or a large portion of their commercial real estate investments into, you know, a separate entity, so as to be able to have that book of business, you know, not be a credit constraint on the ongoing broker-dealer business.
Okay. And our, I believe that meeting was on September 4th, 2008. I mean, I think we're getting that information from the Veloukis report, from the complaint that's been, that the estates filed against J.P. Morgan, and maybe even from some documents that, that you folks have produced. But does that sound consistent with your recollection?
Yes. I honestly didn't remember if it was the third or the fourth, but one of those dates.
Okay. And do you recall who actually who was at that meeting besides yourself?
I don't recall exactly who was at the meeting from J.P. Morgan. I certainly know that representatives of our Treasury Security Services business, so sort of the tri-party repo side of the business, were there, including, I believe, Jane Byers Russo and Dan Doctoroff, and then also Donna DeLoso, who is in our credit area, and I believe there were probably one or two other people there in addition to myself.
And what about from Lehman?
I think that I remember that Ian Lewitt, was there, and their chief risk officer, whose name right now is escaping me, plus one or two other people, possibly I think Dan Fleming from their treasury area, were there.
Was the CRO Mr. O'Meara?
Yes, it was. That's correct.
And was this?
And I believe that he was the person that was designated to become the head of the spinoff company. And I think I said, you know, from J.P. Morgan before that Dan Doctoroff was there. That was probably a slip of the tongue. It's actually Mark Doctoroff. I'm not talking about the New York persona.
And what about Mr. Tannucci? I take it he was probably there?
I actually don't believe Mr. Tannucci was there, although he may have come in and out. But it, as I think you're aware, you know, they obviously were, you know, working on the SpinCo idea and were engaged either at that same time or certainly in preparation for meetings with the rating agencies to try to get them comfortable with the SpinCo approach. And so I believe that Mr. Chinnici was working on that, but I don't know for sure.
Okay. Now, according to Volucas, the complaint, or other documents, I don't have my exact sources, but apparently the next day, September 5th, there is a meeting of J.P. Morgan Chase's Investment Bank Risk Committee. Is that consistent with your recollection?
Yes.
Okay, so tell me about that meeting, please.
At that meeting, we had a discussion of our overall exposures to, you know, the broker-dealer community, to our major broker-dealer clients, and also a discussion specifically of the exposure to Lehman, and we talked about what Lehman was thinking about announcing with respect to SpinCo, how that might, affect their overall credit worthiness.
Okay. I went ahead too quick. When you met with them on the 4th, the day before, I'm sorry, when you met with Lehman on September 4th and you got a report on their 3Q08 results and the SpinCo plan, did you also get, I think it was alleged in the complaint or in the Volucas, that you also got a draft of their presentation that they were going to make to the rating agencies? Does that jog any memory bells?
Yes, during that lunch, they talked about the fact that they were obviously working on this rating agency report or presentation, and I said to Mr. Lewis that, we would very much like, as a major counterparty of Lehman's extending them, credit as we were, to be able to have a copy of that, because we thought that that would be the best way for us to better understand the actual numbers that they were sharing with the rating agencies and the numbers of what their results of operation had been and the way the SpinCo was being designed, so that it, in effect, was a fairly standard approach to our doing, due diligence on a major counterpart. Again, the September 4th meeting was a luncheon meeting, and, it was not practical or appropriate to try to, get into the details of, each of the aspects of the numbers. Mr. Lewis, agreed that that would be, appropriate to do, and also, accepted my offer and suggestion that, in addition, we would be happy to review the rating agency presentation and offer them, our thoughts and advice on what would be the most appropriate ways to try to present these ideas to the rating agencies, and were there things that we could do to help them, obviously as a client, in terms of how they were presenting, these issues and topics to the rating agencies, and then potentially subsequently to the marketplace. Mr. Lewis, very much appreciated that, and understood that it was very much in the mode of the fact that, A, obviously Lehman was a big counterparty and a big credit exposure for J.P. Morgan Chase, but also a very big and important client, and we were looking for ways to be able to help them maximize their opportunity to tell their story to the marketplace.
Okay, so on the 4th, you meet with them. You hear about the 3Q08 results. You hear about SpinCo. You hear about what the plan is to tell the rating agencies. What's the reaction? And I don't mean the reaction to Lehman. What's the thinking? Are there concerns by you folks at J.P. Morgan? Are you thinking things are okay? Or what's the reaction to the information you receive?
We were very concerned. We were concerned about the deterioration of their operations and that their actual, the flow of business that they were doing and earnings that they were trying to generate from that business, were not nearly sufficient to be able to offset the losses that they were taking on inventory positions. And they were therefore obviously going to report a very large loss for the quarter. In addition, we thought that the SpinCo idea had a lot of implementation and execution problems, and we didn't think that there was enough specificity around that idea to be able to give the marketplace and other counterparties in the marketplace comfort that the SpinCo idea A, would actually happen, or B, would actually be successful. And in particular, it was, we thought, not clear in their presentation or the way they described it as to where sufficient capital would come from to underpin the assets and the leverage that was on the SpinCo assets.
Did you share those concerns with Lehman on the 4th?
We shared those concerns with them in a general way, yes. We didn't get the details of the rating agency presentation until the evening, I believe it was the evening of the 4th. And then we did give them that feedback on the morning of the 5th. In addition, on the morning of the 5th, I, in a direct conversation with Mr. Lewis, expressed my concern around those issues. And said that, we very much wanted to, be supportive of them in the marketplace, but that, we were continuing to evaluate it, but it was quite possible, that we would conclude that we needed to ask for additional collateral to be able to continue to be able to provide them with additional extensions of credit, and to also continue to provide new credit against their name in the marketplace. I think one of the things that's important to understand, the other dynamic of what was going on during this period of time, was in addition to our exposures in the tri-party repo marketplace that we've spent a lot of time talking about, we also had exposures as a counterparty to Lehman, and in particular as a derivative counterparty. And what was happening in the marketplace, as you know, other investors, were getting very concerned about having credit extensions to Lehman, and as their stock price was declining and as the CDS spread was widening, reflecting a general market-wide view that the credit of Lehman was deteriorating, counterparties would come to us and other people in the marketplace and say that we have a derivative exposure to Lehman, which we would like to novate or move to J.P. Morgan, or we would like to novate or move that exposure to Goldman Sachs or to Morgan Stanley or to some other counterparty. Certainly, as we were getting towards the end of that week of the 5th and accelerating during the following week of the 9th, we found that other counterparties were shying away and in many instances outright refusing to accept novations from other parties of Lehman exposure. And because of our special relationship with Lehman as the tri-party repo agent and as their main clearance and settlement bank, investors had a natural inclination to want to try to come to J.P. Morgan and novate their exposures to us. And we thought that it was very important in general in the marketplace and very important for the stability of Lehman Brothers to not tell those people in the marketplace that, no, we would not accept their novation to us. So those relationships are a bilateral relationship between us and XYZ investor, do not directly involve Lehman. So we could have taken a view that we weren't going to accept those novations, and it wouldn't have been something that we would directly be discussing with Lehman Brothers. But as soon as we did that, the whole marketplace would know that we were shying away from taking on exposure to Lehman, and we thought that would be very bad for Lehman. And in our discussions, you know, directly with Lehman, you know, both on the 5th, but also the following week, we explained to them how important we thought it was that we take on additional exposure through those novations, and that it was for the benefit of Lehman to put us into that, in effect, additional extension of credit against the Lehman name, which I think the people at Lehman very much agreed with and were very supportive and happy that we were prepared to do that. And so in the subsequent discussions of collateral with them, understood that part of the additional collateral was needed to allow us to continue to provide that marketplace function.
Okay. You mentioned that in these first 2 weeks of September 08 that derivative counterparties were asking J.P. Morgan Chase to novate their Lehman exposure away. Did you see that before the first 2 weeks of September of 2008?
I would say that it accelerated. There certainly was some of that, throughout, the period of time of the summer. But certainly it accelerated in the first 2 weeks of September. And by the week of the 8th, was a I would say in sort of an unquantified way a torrent of novation requests, in part because, as you obviously well know and no doubt are investigating, over the weekend of the 6th and the 7th, when the federal government forced the Freddie and Fannie into conservatorship, in effect, nationalizing those entities, there was a recognition that that was going to have adverse effects on the outstanding existing mortgage paper, of which the marketplace, totally, appreciated and understood that Lehman had a lot of exposure to mortgage type of collateral on their balance sheet, and therefore that weekend event was likely to have an even further negative reaction on the creditworthiness of Lehman. So investors in the marketplace use that as an opportunity to want to, you know, continue to, you know, novate or reduce their exposure to credit of Lehman.
Mm-hmm. When you met with Lehman on September 4th, 2008, any discussion? We know back then, at least, they were still apparently negotiating with the Korean Development Bank about a possible deal. Did you guys discuss that at all?
We talked. I believe that we talked about the fact that they were having those discussions. We didn't go into the detail of the discussions or what the terms, you know, of such an investment might be. There's certainly, I guess I would say that it was offered as, you know, a possibility, but certainly not a certainty. And it was a possibility which, from a credit standpoint, you know, we thought would certainly, I mean, it would have an obvious benefit, but we were also concerned about the ability of such a transaction to get executed in a very short period of time, given what we were being told about the specificity of where they were in their negotiations. And so it did not give us a lot of comfort that such a transaction was very probable to occur.
When did you find out a transaction was not going to occur?
I really don't remember what the time frame was. My recollection is that there wasn't a confirmed, if there ever was a confirmed statement from Lehman Brothers that they were not going to be able to get an investment from KDB until well into the end of the following week. But I don't remember whether that occurred on the 11th or the 12th or over the weekend.
I think there were at least reports in the financial press on the 10th. Did no one at Lehman or anyone else ever told you folks that that deal had fallen through before those public reports?
I don't recall.
Okay, so now we're back to September 5th and the Investment Bank Risk Committee meeting that you folks were having to talk about broker-dealers in general and concerns about Lehman specifically. So what decisions are made, if any, at that meeting?
We decided that we would continue to monitor. We would obviously, you know, continue to monitor the situation on a, you know, minute by minute basis. And in particular, what was the flow of additional novations that were coming to us. We agreed that I would talk to Mr. Lewis to express, you know, our concerns about what they were trying to accomplish and our concerns about about the ability to actually execute it. And in fact, I had that conversation, as I said, with him early in the afternoon on the 5th. And at that time, you know, I said to him that while we had not made a final decision, it was quite possible, you know, that we would need additional collateral, and it might be as much as an additional $5 billion of additional collateral. But left it at that. and agreed that we would, you know, talk if necessary over the weekend or, you know, the beginning of the following week. We also were sensitive to the fact that they were planning on announcing earnings, in fact, pre-announcing earnings and accelerating, you know, when they were going to tell the marketplace what their earnings were and what the story was around how they were trying to pursue these different strategic transactions, you know, early the following week. And so, you know, we were, you know, hoping that that might bring some degree of stability to the marketplace.
So by September 5th, or by the end of the day, September 5th, had J.P. Morgan decided whether or not it was going to require additional collateral be posted by Lehman?
No, we had not made a definitive determination at that time.
Chris, at a convenient time, do you want to take a five-minute break?
Sure. All right, so I think we just finished talking about September 5th and the Investment Bank Risk Committee and your conversations with Mr. Lewitt about possibly asking for another $5 billion of collateral. Tell me what's next in the Lehman chronology.
I'm not sure what's next. I mean, I think obviously the following week familiar with the ongoing impact in the marketplace after, you know, the Freddie Fannie conservatorship, as we talked about, and leading up to market concerns about what earnings Lehman was going to report. I guess by that point they had said that they were going to pre-announce their earnings. You know, I believe they were going to pre-announce them on the 10th. But over the course of Monday and Tuesday, the marketplace continued to react, as I said, very, very negatively to Lehman. We continued to get lots of additional novations of credit exposure to the Lehman name, and therefore our credit exposure was growing, and we were also becoming concerned about the character of the collateral that we were holding, because it was not cash, and so on Tuesday the 9th. We had a conversation with Lehman in which we said that we did feel that it was necessary to have them post, you know, an additional amount of collateral with us, and we said that we thought they should post an additional $5 billion.
And who's talking to who when that request is made?
On Tuesday early afternoon, there was a conversation initially between Steve Black and Dick Fuld. I was with Steve for that initial conversation, but I was not on the speakerphone. Steve was talking directly to Mr. Fuld.
Okay. I take it that means you don't know what Mr. Fold's response was.
I did not hear Mr. Fold's direct response. Is my recollection? I don't think so.
Okay. What did Mr. Black tell you?
Mr. Black said that Mr. Black talked with Mr. Fold about what was happening in the marketplace, about the novations that we were getting, about the continued widening of Lehman CDS spreads and the decline in stock price, all of which obviously Mr. Fold was, I assume, well aware of, and that we asked for the additional collateral, I believe that Mr. Fold, said that he would have to talk to, his people, which, I assume meant his finance and treasury people.
Okay. As I suspect you know, there is an allegation in that complaint filed by the estate that on the 9th, Mr. Diamond and other J.P. Morgan Chase senior officers met with Bernanke and Paulson to discuss Lehman and learned that the federal government was unlikely to provide support to Lehman. My first question is, do you know if that meeting occurred, and were you part of that meeting?
There were a series of meetings that our operating committee members were having in Washington on that day of the 9th. And yes, I was part of the meeting that Mr. Paulson participated in, and I was part of the meeting that Mr. Diamond had with Mr. Bernanke.
Okay. And was anything said about the prospects of the federal government providing assistance to Lehman?
No. There was no statement in which either Mr. Bernanke nor Mr. Paulson said that they would not, that any decision had been made or any approach. There was no discussion even of what approach the government might take if Lehman got into further financial distress.
So what were the discussions?
In both instances, they were overall discussions about what was happening in the marketplace, what the reactions were to the Freddie Fannie situation, to what was happening in the tri-party repo marketplace, and what some of the longer-term, agenda items were going to be for the government in trying to further stabilize the marketplace.
Were these meetings before or after the call with between Mr. Fold and Mr. Black about the five bill?
They were in the morning, and then the call between Mr. Black and Mr. Fold was in the afternoon.
Okay. When you were having the meetings with Mr. Paulson and Mr. Bernanke, did you tell them that you were going to be making a $5 billion demand on Lehman?
No, it wasn't relevant to the discussions that we were having, and we hadn't made a final decision about whether or not to make such a call.
Okay. During the meeting on the 9th, any discussion about any institutions other than Lehman when you're talking with Paulson and Bernanke?
Well, yes, we talked about what had happened with Freddie and Fannie. We talked about what was happening in general in the tri-party marketplace, so that meant, in general about other broker-dealers. And we talked about, what was happening in the marketplace, with respect to, the concerns in the marketplace over, where Lehman spreads were and stock price was and what impact that was having on other broker-dealers. But it was not a discussion about, any of those institutions on an individual basis.
Okay. So no discussions about, for example, either Merrill Lynch or AIG?
My recollection was only in the context of those general market discussions.
Okay. Don, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt the flow there. But just during that meeting, you mentioned that there was discussion about the tri-party repo market. Was there any discussion as to whether or not J.P. Morgan would unwind daily, would continue to unwind daily as repo exposures to Lehman?
No.
At any point, did the Fed encourage J.P. Morgan not to stop unwinding on a daily basis? We had heard perhaps there was some discussion about that on the 15th.
On what date?
September 15th, the Friday before the bankruptcy, I think.
That's the 12th.
That's the actual Monday after the day I would. There certainly were discussions with the New York Fed around the efficacy of doing the unwind over the weekend of the 13th and the 14th. And so certainly on the 14th, when it became clear that there was not going to be a strategic solution for Lehman, and at a minimum the holding company was going to file for bankruptcy sometime the night of the 14th or the morning of the 15th, we did have discussions with the New York Fed about whether or not it was appropriate to do an unwind on the morning of the 15th.
And I don't want to interrupt the chronology you were doing, but was that the first time you discussed any potential possibility of J.P. Morgan not doing a daily unwind? The 14th, that weekend?
Yes, certainly to the best of my recollection. I mean, I think that, you know, the specific discussions, you know, around that, what was appropriate for the marketplace, you know, were happening on that weekend of the 13th and 14th.
Okay. And I'll follow up when Chris is done with everything, but I don't want to get him off.
Too late. All right. So on September 9th again, I'm sure you know this. There's an allegation in the complaint that J.P. Morgan sent a team to Lehman to conduct due diligence regarding a potential investment by J.P. Morgan in Lehman. Do you know anything about that?
So yes, coming out of the discussions on the 9th with Mr. Foles and others. And consistent with, you know, the whole series of discussions that, you know, I had with Ian Lewitt and, you know, others and Mr. Black had with Mr. Fold, you know, we certainly said, look, if there are other things that we can do to be helpful to either support, you know, the SpinCo transaction or other things, we would certainly be prepared to, you know, talk with Lehman about that. And so I believe that Mr. Fold, you know, asked if we could have a team of, you know, senior people, you know, join some of his senior people the evening of the 9th. And in fact, you know, we had, you know, as part of that team, you know, the head of our U.S. Investment banking business. Go, you know, seek to, you know, have a dialogue with them, but nothing, you know, came out of those discussions. And my recollection is that Lehman never really sent anyone senior to engage in a fulsome discussion or with, you know, robust information.
But maybe I just didn't hear you correctly. I mean, did J.P. Morgan send a due diligence, quote-unquote, team over to Lehman to start looking at the books in the context of possibly investing in Lehman?
As I said, we had people go meet with them. It was not set up as a due diligence session. It was, I believe, originally set up in which Lehman would share with us, you know, what they were at that point thinking of doing or other structures that they might consider in which J.P. Morgan might be able to participate. But I don't believe that they ever came with
actual information or a senior team to engage in that type of a dialogue. Our folks, I think, sat in a conference room for several hours and before anyone actually came.
Okay. So on the 9th earlier in the day, or at some point in the day, the phone call occurs between Mr. Black and Mr. Fuld about the $5 billion. And you said that Mr. Fuld said, let me talk to my Treasury guys and get back to you. What happens next on that front?
There's a subsequent conversation later in the day, I don't recall exactly when, in which it was agreed that they would post, additional collateral. There was, some discussion about what the amount of that additional collateral posting would be, and they understood that they were trying to get to a posting of about $5 billion. They didn't think that they would be able to immediately post all of that amount. And so there was an agreement, I believe, that they would post, roughly, I think 3.6 or $3.9 billion of collateral the next day.
And who, when you said there was another call, was it between Mr. Black and Mr. Fuld again?
I believe that's correct.
Okay, I take it since you say you believe you weren't in Mr. Black's office this time.
No, because as we said, we'd been down in Washington, and I had left to take a train to my home, and he left to travel back to his home.
Okay. Okay. So what's next? I mean, I think both the Veloukis report, I believe, and the complaint, I believe, say that, J.P. Morgan required Lehman to enter into a new series of agreements before they pre-announced 3Q08 results, which I believe they not only did on the 10th, but did on the 10th before the markets opened. Is that consistent with your recollection?
Well, it's consistent, as we said, that following the discussion on the 9th, we said that we wanted to have the collateral in, by the open of the next day. So if yes, it would be correct that was occurring, around the same time that they were pre-announcing their earnings.
Okay, and do you know whether or not J.P. Morgan said, look, we want the collateral and we want the agreements executed, but before you guys go public with your pre-announcement?
I'm not aware of anyone linking it to the pre-announcement. It was the fact that we had made a determination, that given the additional collateral, additional innovations that we were taking, and our ongoing, unwinding of the tri-party book of business, every morning, that it was important that we have that additional collateral posted, roughly, before the open of the markets. But so it was related to the markets as opposed to anything to do with the pre-announcement.
Okay. At any time on either the 9th or the 10th, or I guess before the collateral got posted, did J.P. Morgan Chase indicate what action it would take, if any, if Lehman didn't post at least the $3.3 or the $3.6 billion?
All of our discussions revolved around, how we could continue to be supportive of Lehman, continue to be able to try to have as good a functioning tri-market repo marketplace and
Novation marketplace, you know, around the Lehman name, and it was all you know, in that context that we were talking with the Lehman people.
Understanding it was in the context of J.P. Morgan being helpful. Did J.P. Morgan say, for example, if you don't post the collateral, we're not going to clear your trades?
Not that I'm aware of. And in addition, you know, again, remember that the clearance of trades is a different function than the tri-party market repo activities. It's the tri-party repo activities in which we extend, you know, the $100+ billion worth of credit.
Right.
In the clearance and settlement business, you know, that's not where that credit exposure was being generated.
Right. And then that's what I should have asked. I mean, did J.P. Morgan any time say we're not going to provide the intraday credit if you don't post the collateral?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Okay. By the way, I meant to ask you this earlier and I forgot to. When all the novations are coming in and you folks are novating people's trades with Lehman, is there some kind of report that J.P. Morgan had that would show us that so we could sort of see what the increase was? It's very helpful in terms of our, if it exists, in terms of our too-big-to-fail, systemically important institution to sort of see the timing of that. And if there was a report that would show us that at J.P. Morgan, that would be helpful. Do you know if there is such a beast?
I'm not familiar with a specific report that showed those novations, you know, what the exact flow of the novations were on that sort of a day-to-day basis. I mean, we certainly looked at what our credit exposure was, but the credit exposure on any given day, you know, was reflective of both, you know, new transactions as well as old transactions, and would change based on the dynamics of the pricing in the marketplace.
As J.P. Morgan was novating these trades, what were you guys doing to cover that increased risk, if anything?
Well, one of the things that we were doing was we were having the discussions with Lehman Brothers about their providing additional collateral to cover that additional credit risk.
Anything else?
Not that I'm specifically aware of. We thought that the most appropriate way to cover the additional credit risk was through bilateral discussions with Lehman Brothers, that we were engaging in these transactions to be supportive of Lehman in the marketplace, and we thought that the best way to protect the increased credit exposure was by having additional collateral posted.
Do you know if J.P. Morgan Chase was buying any CDS protection against Lehman?
I don't recall. I'm not aware that we were, and that certainly was not. It was not a. That was not a strategy that would be designed to cover these additional exposures that, you know, given the dynamics in the marketplace.
Okay. So the 3.3 or 3.6 billion, whatever number it was, it does get posted on the 10th before the markets open. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Okay.
And then I believe, you know, the additional amount that they had said that they were going to post to get us closer to that $5 billion came in on Thursday the 11th.
Okay. Okay. Okay, so let's go to the 11th, because I think that's when you guys ask for more, right?
That's correct.
And if I'm skipping an event, that tell me, and we'll cover that event first.
Well, I think, you know, again, you know, an important event is that, you know, each day of that week, we continue to unwind the tri-party, you know, repo business in a business-as-usual context, notwithstanding the fact that the marketplace for Lehman and the market's view of Lehman's credit worthiness, you know, was deteriorating, you know, rapidly. So, you know, again, I think that when you think about the collateral calls during the course of that week and the interactions, you know, remember that each day, I don't remember the exact amounts, but, you know, each day we're unwinding, you know, roughly $140 billion of overnight repo and extending, you know, that credit to them on a, you know, somewhat collateralized basis.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, on the 10th, they obviously pre-announced their earnings. The market does not, you know, react real well to that, and the pricing of their securities and the flow of novations continues to accelerate on Thursday the 11th. And also on Thursday the 11th, as we're reviewing our collateral position, we determined that, you know, a significant portion of the collateral they had been posted going back to the August postings, you know, was in a form, you know, that was subject to a significant diminution in value based upon the creditworthiness of Lehman itself, and that we felt that the value of that collateral was way overstated from an actual valuation standpoint. And that led us to conclude on the evening of Thursday the 11th that we needed to ask them to post additional collateral in the form of cash in order, in part, large part, to make up for what was the diminution in value based upon the market forces, as well as you know, frankly, you know, the correlation, if you will, between the Lehman credit and the value of the collateral for that other collateral that had been posted.
Mm-hmm. In the complaint that the estate filed against J.P. Morgan Chase, they said that the collateral amounts posted on the 9th, 10th, and 11th were all posted under protest. Do you recall Lehman saying, all right, we'll post it, but we're doing it under protest, or is that inconsistent with your memory?
That's inconsistent with my memory. In all the discussions that I had, there was a very clear recognition of the commercial reasonableness given the amount of credit that we were extending to Lehman, you know, every day through the unwind, and the amount of credit that we were extending in the marketplace through the novations, and the importance of that to Lehman's, the perception of Lehman's viability, they understood that this was something that was appropriate for us to ask for, at least in my judgment, in my conversations with them, and the commercial reasonableness of it.
Okay. So on the 11th, J.P. Morgan demands another $5 billion. Tell me the circumstances of that, if you're involved in the call, or in who else is, and et cetera.
Right. So as I said, on the 11th, you know, we evaluated the amount of collateral that we had in-house. You know, as I said, we felt that a lot of the collateral that had previously been posted, you know, leading up to, the collateral that had previously been posted was not, did not have as much value as Lehman had represented it had to us. And we determined that
there should be a discussion with Mr. Paul to have a to post an additional $5 billion of cash collateral prior to the open of business on Friday the 12th. And Mr. Black and Mr. Diamond had a call with Mr. Fold. We were on the speakerphone, you know, I and some others were with Mr. Black during that call, and I believe that Mr. Fold and Mr. McDade and Mr. Lewitt, at a minimum, were on the Lehman side. We explained to them, you know, what was happening in the marketplace, what was happening with innovations, what our concerns were with the existing collateral that had been posted, and said that we needed to have $5 million of cash. There was some back and forth, you know, discussion. I don't know whether it was Mr. Lewitt or Mr. Tannucci. I frankly had a hard time recognizing which accent it was. Said, you know, were expressed their concern about having to do that. Mr. McDade, I believe it was, cut them off and said to us that he understood what we were asking for. And why we needed it, and that they would go ahead and post it, and that was, you know, where the conversation ended.
Okay. Do you recall if anyone else on the call from Lehman? Do you know if their counsel, Mr. Cohen, was on the call?
I do not know.
Okay.
Certainly, I don't recall such a person ever identifying himself.
Okay. So you remember the four, Fold, McDade, Lewitt, and Tannucci?
Yes, as I said, I'm not sure whether it was Lewitt or Tannucci. It might have been both of them. One of them spoke, but I just couldn't pick up, based on the accent, which one it was.
Okay. So did anyone, I may have missed what you said right before, you said McDade cut him off and said we understand and we'll post it. Did anyone from Lehman ever during the call say we can't post it, we don't have the ability to post it?
No.
Okay. Did anyone ever say that if we post it, it's going to really make it difficult for us to do our business otherwise? You're
no.
Taking what we got left?
No.
Okay. Did you guys? Did J.P. Morgan Chase? Did you provide intraday credit as a clearing bank for AIG?
No, we don't. Again, AIG was not a. So, again, going back to the terminology, clearing bank doesn't provide intraday credit. The tri-party agent bank provides the intraday credit, and it was through our tri-party relationship with, in terms of large numbers, it's the tri-party relationship with Lehman where we provided, you know, over $100 billion of intraday credit, and we don't have that relationship with AIG. We did have other bilateral lending relationships with AIG, but they were not significant.
I will try to use agent bank and clearing bank correctly. I know I've been butchering it the whole time. Did Lehman ever ask for the $5 billion back after it posted it?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay. Any issues with, was it a cash posting?
I believe it was, I think it was posted in the form of cash and some money market investments that were money market investments in J.P. Morgan money market funds.
Do you understanding you never heard that Lehman asked for the money back? Do you recall if there was nevertheless a directive within J.P. Morgan to not return it if they did?
No, I'm not aware of any such directive.
Not using the word directive, then. I mean, I don't want to limit it by using that word, but was there a policy? I mean, was there any discussion about, look, if they ask for the $5 billion back, it's not to be returned?
I think that everybody recognized that the collateral was posted to secure the credit exposures that we were taking to Lehman. And so, in the ordinary course, any such change in our credit stature would have had to require some discussion.
Were you at the New York Fed during the Lehman weekend?
Yes.
Okay. So what? I know there was a bunch of people there doing different things. What group were you part of when you were there?
So I was certainly involved in discussions with New York Fed, as I said, around what was going to be the mechanics around the tri-party repo exposures on Monday the 15th, and then I was I forget frankly right now which of the sub working groups I was participating in. I believe it was principally the backup, credit facility sub-working group, and I was also participating with the sub-working group focused on trying to establish a derivatives novation protocol, among other dealers.
Right. And we've heard and read and I think even seen in documents and other interviews about this derivative netting exercise that went on Sunday from 2 to 6. Are you familiar with that?
I'm generally familiar with the efforts to do that. I don't recall. My recollection was that very little transactions actually occurred on that afternoon, if any.
Do you know why?
I think because it was very difficult to get sufficient information from Lehman Brothers about what their exposures were to different counterparties in order to be able to try to figure out how individual counterparties might pair themselves off in order to net down, exposures.
Okay. One of the reasons I ask is we've seen, I think, in some filings in the bankruptcy court that, immediately pre-bankruptcy, Lehman had ballpark 930,000 derivative contracts, and shortly after the bankruptcy gets filed, they're down to like 200,000. And of course, we knew about the netting exercise, so I was possibly wondering or inferring that a bunch of stuff did get done that Sunday.
I'm not familiar with those particular transaction numbers, but it certainly that certainly does not comport with my recollection of what actually happened on that afternoon. Okay. I don't believe that there was any significant amount of netting that occurred.
Okay. Of course, we know that the Tuesday after the Monday bankruptcy of Lehman that the Fed makes, or the New York Fed makes, the $85 billion loan to AIG. When you're at the New York Fed over the weekend, are you involved or know of any discussions about AIG?
I was not involved in discussions around AIG on that weekend, other than obviously knowing from a JP Morgan standpoint of, you know, the concerns and the potential fragility of the situation.
Understanding you weren't involved in discussions, did you know that discussions were going on that weekend regarding AIG?
I'm sorry, discussions with whom?
Amongst government officials and others.
Not that I remember, no.
Okay. Do you know of any J.P. Morgan officials ever expressed concern to any government officials that weekend, or frankly even before that weekend, about AIG's, you know, financial condition and what their failure would mean in terms of systemic consequences?
Chris, I understand we want to give you latitude. The subject we thought was JPM Lehman collateral. We're now fifth question on AIG. We've not spoken to Mr. Zubrow about AIG.
No,
and we've already given you witnesses on the subject of AIG.
Okay. Really? Who have I spoken to about AIG?
Mark Feldman.
Dixie. Oh, okay. Sorry, that wasn't me. But it was somebody else. That's fine, Eric. The only reason I bring it up is because, candidly, I didn't know Mr. Zubrow was at the New York Fed that weekend. And one of the things we've been looking at is, you know, probably not a surprise, you know, Lehman fails, AIG does not. So I was really just curious on a general matter if Mr. Zubrow, you know, had heard, you know, anything about discussions about AIG that weekend. So, I mean, I can leave it at that.
Again, I have no problem with him answering the question. I was just sort of trying to forestall more of them. And we also are, you know, we're at 4 o'clock and we would like to get done as soon as we can.
No, you're sure. And I'm all for that. I have another interview at 4:30, so I have to hustle too. And I think we're close. So let me look at my notes here and see what else we have to do.
Yeah, that would be helpful because I'm actually supposed to meet my son at the airport to be traveling with him, so I don't want to leave him stranded.
Okay. Right, so let's just, the one question that was outstanding on AIG, and then Eric, I'll stop. You know, do you just recall any discussions about AIG that weekend, or hearing anything about AIG?
No, I mean, I think that people were, in general, people were aware that AIG, you know, was trying to figure out its financial stability approach. But certainly there were no discussions that I directly participated in, you know, at the Fed around AIG and its relationship to the events of Lehman.
Okay. Did you think, my last question, my colleagues have a couple. Did you think Lehman was too big to fail? Did you think the government would provide some type of assistance to prevent them from failing?
I don't know, what the government was going to do. I actually thought that there would be some sort of that Lehman would figure out a strategic transaction for itself. And so that was my expectation that, you know, they would find a strategic solution.
Mr. Zubrow, just a few questions. Just to clarify, during the summer of 2008, was J.P. Morgan doing its own pricing of Lehman's collateral?
We In the tri-party repo market, we use external vendors that do the pricing of the tri-party collateral. That's what our agreement with our broker-dealer clients and our investing clients call for.
So was September 11th the first time you raised the valuations of Lehman's collateral?
We had raised with Lehman, as well as other tri-party clients, concerns that the external valuation agents were not properly valuing a lot of the structured collateral, and in fact had started to engage the firm Gifford Fong to be an external pricing agent to try to more accurately price some of the structured credit collateral.
And during the summer of 2008, in your discussions or interactions with the New York Fed, did you hear anything about a game plan to let an investment bank fail or a willingness to let Lehman fail that summer?
No, never.
Good afternoon, Mr. Zebro. A couple questions about your role as tri-party clearing bank. You know, if you give me a minute, probably just want to make sure. How profitable was that business on an annualized basis, just ballpark, and hopefully Eric can follow up with this as well. But just looking at 06, 07, and 08, any ballpark numbers on how profitable that was to J.P. Morgan?
I don't have specific numbers around the profitability of that business. I think that, you know, we think about that as one piece of our overall relationship through providing clearance and settlement and tri-party services. And so I don't have I just don't know.
And did J.P. Morgan ultimately lose money doing its daily unwinds? And I want to look at two particular unwinds that it did. And one was when it, let me just go to Lehman. When it unwound for Lehman on the 14th, J.P. Morgan would have had time to slowly sell those positions?
Okay, on the 14th, that was a Sunday.
Fair enough. The 15th, when they opened, I understand that they did fully unwind. And Mr. Zubrow mentioned that there was some discussion about that being good for the markets.
So on the 15th, we did, you know, do an unwind. So again, Lehman Brothers Holdings goes bankrupt, and we went ahead on Monday morning the 14th, as well as each of those subsequent days. I'm sorry, 15th. Each of the subsequent days that week, 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th, and continued to provide the full tri-party repo services for Lehman Brothers, the U.S. broker-dealer, which is who we have that relationship with. And continue to provide, certainly at the beginning of that week, you know, over $100 billion worth of credit extension, which over the course of that week wound down. And we continued to do that, as I said, and allowed for the tri-party repo market as a whole and for Lehman Brothers specifically to continue to function the way it was designed.
Let me try to better word that question. I understand that J.P. Morgan did do that for market stability and did all of that. But the question is, at the end of the day, did J.P. Morgan lose money on that, or did you find yourself fully collateralized?
I think that with the benefit of the additional collateral that we had received from Lehman Brothers. You know, we, when you look at our overall collateral position going into that week, it certainly, and obviously some of this is subject to ongoing litigation, so, you know, I'm not sure how we will ultimately net out. But certainly sitting here today, I would expect that we were not fully collateralized for the series of exposures that we took on during that week.
And understanding that that's not completely resolved, would do you believe that you were under collateralized by tens of billions, or I mean, can you put any parameters around what your expectation is?
No, I think it's like that would be, you know, sort of speculative to try to figure out where it will ultimately net out. But certainly, you know, with the exposure we took on that day for the tri-party market unwind on, you know, Monday morning the 15th, you know, was, you know, over $100 billion. That, you know, got rolled in subsequent days. But again, I think that, you know, we will probably net out being, having been under collateralized through, you know, the whole panoply of exposures that we had during that week.
I just have one final question. Prior to the cash and cash equivalent posting you got on September 11th from Lehman, if my math is right, you had some $10 billion of collateral posted before that. Do you know the percentage of that which was mortgage-backed securities and structured finance products?
Okay, so I think that the $10 billion that you're referring to was the addition of the $5 billion in August and what had been intended to be $5 billion from the collateral call on the 9th, but that second $5 billion, I think, only resulted in, you know, roughly an additional, you know, $2.6 or $2.9 billion actually getting posted. And of that amount, so that call $8 billion is what relates to what you said was $10 billion, but so of that $8 billion, I think that close to $5 billion of that was in the form of various structured securities and commercial paper that had significant valuation issues relative to a collapse of Lehman Brothers.
Any idea how much of it was related to mortgage products? Or mortgage, any relation to that?
I don't think about it in that way. I'm not trying to be difficult. I just don't think about it that way.
No, I understand. It may not be something that you ever did the math on. So the collateral wasn't brought up to 10. I thought you said earlier that they posted 2.6 or 2.9 billion, but then. In the following days, they brought that up to a full $5 billion on the second?
No, I think that they sought to bring it up over the course of the 9th and the 10th, or over the course of the 10th and the 11th, but they never actually accomplished that. And they also asked for some collateral that they had previously posted to be returned to them. I think we think that they were going to use that to post somewhere else, but I don't know for sure. And so net, it never got up to that full amount.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much for your patience.
I have. Okay. I guess I'm last on the list, Art. I'd like to go to risk management and to the beginning of the interview, if I might, please. You talked about a team of credit experts evaluating counterparties. And with respect to Lehman, you described three different lines of business: clearance and settlement, derivative trading transactions, and the asset management business, just in general terms. What I'm curious about is the flow of information from each of those lines of business to your experts that are trying to evaluate the credit quality of Lehman or other counterparties.
So I think just to go back and correct a little bit of the language that you just used in the question, when we think of lines of business, I would describe the investment bank and Treasury Security Services as a line of business.
Okay.
Clearance and settlement is a product area, or tri-party is a product area. Derivatives trading is a product area. Those three product areas would be within either the investment bank or Treasury Security Services, both of which are on the wholesale side of our business, and the credit decisions for those are done by the credit team on the private side of the bank, located within the investment bank.
Okay.
On the asset management side, that they would have a separate credit team which makes their own credit decisions about what the exposure should be for the asset, for representing, you know, clients that, you know, have us invest their money.
Okay. Given that, am I right then in inferring that the asset management, any information from that side would go only to that team and wouldn't cross the line to the other team that's serving the other two product lines?
That would be correct.
So let's set the asset management side aside and talk just about clearance, settlement, and derivatives trading. Clearly, you got information from the market on the degree that people were approaching you for novations. I'm interested in the flow of other kinds of information from those two product lines to your experts that were trying to evaluate counterparty credit risk. What kind of information was coming in?
They would have information which was of about. They would have access to what the size of the tri-party book was, and would participate in a discussion of the character of that book. So there's nothing, it's all within the private side structure of the credit relationship between J.P. Morgan Chase and Lehman Brothers, and Lehman or other clients would be fully aware that those credit people would have access to that information.
I'm just curious about early signals before the novations start coming in, and as you said, accelerating in September of 2008, sort of the kind of information you would be getting from either the clearance settlement side or the derivative trading side that would be an early signal that you needed to pay attention to a particular counterparty.
I think that the general trading parameters of any counterparty, in the marketplace, as is reflected by their CDS spreads, their stock price, the volume of trading activity in their name, would be, information that would be very readily available, to most counterparties, but yes, would be used by credit analysts as a indication of how other counterparties may be viewing a particular counterparty's credit.
So besides those pieces of information like CDS spreads, et cetera, that are available to other parties in the market, you didn't receive information from clearance settlement activities, derivatives trading activities that you would have had that other people wouldn't have had?
I think that the our credit people would receive lots of information directly from Lehman Brothers or about our business with Lehman Brothers, which reflects the confidential proprietary nature of our relationship as a counterpart with Lehman Brothers.
So when did you receive the first flag that you had to be worried about Lehman Brothers as a counterparty? Was there anything special that happened besides the usual adjustments in the course of business?
I guess I'm not sure that, as with any credit judgment, there's necessarily a specific first flag. As you know, we talked about at the beginning of this discussion, you know, throughout the fall of 07 and during the course of all of 08, you know, we were very concerned about the overall leverage of the broker dealers, the composition of their assets, and so on. So I don't period.
So basically, leverage was something the market could also perceive. Composition of assets might have been harder, but you're basically saying you didn't have information flowing in from your business relationships that would have triggered any particular concerns that you wouldn't have gotten from information available to other people in the market?
I guess I would say that in the ordinary course of our dealings with Lehman Brothers as a client, where we are extending credit to them, they have an obligation to provide us, you know, robust information about their business, about the composition of their assets, what's happening, which is information that they may or may not choose to make available to other counterparties, but which, given the nature of our counterparty relationship, they choose to disclose to us.
Okay, thanks. I think that's it. Thank you very much.
Sure. Take. Can we just put you on mute for 1 second?
Absolutely.
Okay, we're back, everybody.
Yeah, okay.
We just wanted to we're fine. we'll be in touch.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Actually, can I ask one very last question? As you know, our next hearing is focused on Too Big to Fail, and I just want to confirm, coming into that weekend, notwithstanding Secretary Paulson's statement that there will be no public financing, were you surprised at all that Sunday when Lehman did in fact or was directed to file bankruptcy?
I'm not sure that I would say. I wouldn't characterize the emotions. I would say that, you know, I certainly had been hopeful that at least, you know, one of the two potential strategic transactions that was being discussed would come to fruition. And so I guess, if anything, I was probably, you know, most surprised that that it appears that the UK government, you know, was not willing to allow Barclays Bank to proceed with an overall acquisition that weekend. And so that obviously cut off, you know, that as an alternative.
So Secretary Paulson's statement that there will be no public financing, you took it for its word. You didn't see it as a negotiating point for the consortium to come up with a private solution.
Well, I think I think everybody took it as a clear expression that it was important to come up with a private solution. The private solution might have been a consortium solution, or more likely, it might have been a strategic transaction.
And my very last question this time. You've been in Wall Street for a while. Why do you think Lehman failed? If you could just summarize for us your personal views.
My personal view is that Lehman failed because they had too much leverage invested in
assets that were too risky for the composition of their balance sheet, and that as they began to suffer credit deterioration, they were too slow to take actions that would restore their financial flexibility and financial health.
That's great. Well, thanks for your answers.
Thanks again.
Okay, thank you.
Take care. Thank you all very much.
Bye-bye.
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 Bye.
Everybody's on mute.
Yeah. That's gonna happen.